This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Over the years, going to the movies during the holidays has arguably been added to our treasure trove of traditions. Whether people just want to get out of the house, have time on their hands, or are bored after opening the presents and need a new diversion, Hollywood counts on you going to the movies at this time of year. And for that reason, they roll out a crop of films they hope will bring you in, perhaps more than once, and also use this time to build up some box office bragging rights for films they hope will be Oscar contenders. But not all of them are Oscar contenders, and with holiday credit card bills mounting, most of us want to spend our movie money as wisely as possible. So with that in mind, we welcome back our intrepid critics, Matt Brunson and Sean O'Connell. Matt, of course, is film editor, A&E editor. I don't know what that means. I guess he works for A&E. And senior editor at Creative Loafing, someone who obviously needs an editor to edit his various editor titles. Good morning and welcome back.
Yeah, hi, how are you doing?
And Sean is movie content director for CinemaBlend.com, whose reviews have and continue to appear in publications everywhere, including RottenTomatoes.com. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
All righty. Now that people have big screen TVs in every room of the house, 60, 70, 80 inches, and they get Xboxes for Christmas, do they really go to the movies? Are holiday films the draw they once were, or do people simply cocoon?
It really depends on the movies being offered. Like this year, they're predicting it's not going to do as well just because there's not going to be as much that people are dying to see. But in other seasons, if you have something that everybody on the planet is really interested in, then it's going to peak more.
I mean, does this kind of thing where we have big screens at home and great sound systems at home, some people, not all, cause action films and things that really look special on the big screen and in big rooms?
Yeah, some. I mean,
it drives that.
Interstellar, as an example, Christopher Nolan's film was designed to be seen on a big screen, particularly in IMAX. And, I think if you waited to watch that at home, one of the largest selling points of it being the visuals is going to be decreased. And there are other films that are event films. They become event films. The Hobbit, they're hashtagging it one last time because they want it to be a communal experience of fans of those films coming together. Same with The Hunger Games, too. I think if you're a fan of those Hunger Games films, you're going to show up to see the third one and then eventually the fourth one together with fans.
I mean, the Oscars are around the corner, right? They're in March, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. March.
How important is this time of year and how important is good box office to a movie released at this time of year for it to become either a nominee or a successful nominee, a winner?
Oh, it's very important. That's why, you know, it's the usual complaint if they don't release anything worthwhile for the first 9 months of the year. Then in the last few months, and especially the last few weeks, they just start piling on the quality movies because they know that a lot of people just have short-term memories, especially Academy voters. So they want to hold all the big guns till the end of the year.
Well, I find that happens, too. Like, National Board of Review nominated their films, and they went heavy on a film called A Most Violent Year, which they screened, like, days before they nominated it. And it's a very good movie with some really good performances. But I'm not quite sure if it came out in October that it would have the same impact. They would probably go with something like Selma or American Sniper because they just watched it a few days ago.
How many movies do you guys see every year? Do you know?
Close to, I'm over like 150, close to 200.
Yeah, I'm always in between like 175 to 200.
Is that more than you used to look at in review, or is it less? Are they coming out with more films or less films, I guess is the question.
I don't know that there's been that much of a difference in films. I think it's mainly what time we have to see movies. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a few, that fall by the wayside. So I think they've been pretty steady with the film production. I know some studios have said they're cutting back on movies, but I really haven't seen it. I mean, it just seems like every week we get five or six openings.
It's easier to see things now, too. Like, I'll catch up with things that I miss on Netflix because they hit Netflix so much earlier than they used to. It used to be that six-month window, and now, there are films that I'm zipping through Netflix on a monthly basis, and I'm seeing three or four things, that I just happened to miss during the theatrical
window. Oh, there's
a
movie now called The Homesman that they're going to push for Oscars with Tommy Lee Jones and Hilary Swank, and I just saw ads saying it's going to be out on Blu-ray in February. I mean, February, we're still in award season.
Right.
I came back from Toronto one year, and there was a Parkland, it was called. It was a JFK assassination movie. And I tried to move my schedule around to see it while I was up there. And I was able to like secure an online screener from the publicist. And I sat in my hotel room and I watched it. Came back from the festival and went to like a CVS. And it was by the register. It was like sitting there in the DVD. I'm like, I killed myself to see it up there. I could have come home and watched it.
It used to be a sign that the movie was a turkey if it went right to video or very quickly to video from right. The theaters. That's not the stigma anymore?
No, not always. A lot of times it's if the movie did really well in theaters, they would like to, like, for example, beat, you know, get it in stores by Christmas so people can buy it.
Aren't they cannibalizing sales or ticket sales?
I sometimes think that. I think especially with Oscar contenders or movies they know they can be, when I see it released on video or Blu-ray, DVD, whatever, in January, February, I'm thinking, well, why didn't they just hold it another 2 months? They could plaster the ads with Oscars.
Well, let me ask you this, because movies used to be big because and they had movie stars, and they did not do television because that was a different level of the business, a lesser level of the business, and it was a much smaller screen. Mm-hmm. If you make movies which are designed to be in a movie theater and you have movie stars in them, and suddenly everybody is seeing them on Netflix or going to the video store, buying them at the CVS at the checkout counter as an impulse purchase and popping them in the Blu-ray player, it is no longer a movie. It's a television show.
Well, yes and no.
There are certain, on the TV screen.
But there are filmmakers that still design their films to be seen big. Exodus, Gods and Kings is an example. Like Ridley Scott made that to be a big screen movie, and he cast Christian Bale, because Christian Bale is a big screen movie star. Yeah, you'll probably end up watching it later on a television screen, but he didn't design it that way.
Well, and there's no dividing line now. I mean, if you look at like the Golden Globe nominations or Emmy Award nominations at Who's Up for TV Awards,
right.
It's big movie stars. I mean, you're going to get people like Helen Mirren for some HBO movie
Why is that? Is that because there are fewer movies for Helen Mirren to make or fewer good movies or more opportunities in television? What is it?
I think it's more opportunities. I mean, Helen Mirren has no trouble getting work. A lot of other big stars, same thing. But they see a good script, and if it's, you know, HBO or quality network, then they're like, yeah, I'm going to commit to this because I know it's going to be as classy as any movie.
The Golden Globe Award nominees came out last week. That can sometimes be a precursor to the Academy Awards. A small film, a quirky film, a really good film, I thought, that's been playing at the Manor Theater for a while now was among the nominees. Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. I love the subtitle. It led the Golden Globe nominations with 7. Matt, you gave this film 4 stars. Sean, I could not find your review of this film, but Rotten Tomatoes gave it 94%. I loved it. It's about a movie star superhero played by Michael Keaton who moved beyond his superhero days, and he's battling his demons and his ego in a play on Broadway. It's a show within a show.
It is, and I'll argue that I think you liked it more than I did because you have theater roots also. I think it preaches to a specific choir. I found it to be kind of shallow and pretty pretentious, and I didn't think that it – I thought it was entertaining, and I thought everybody in it was really good, but I didn't think it was about anything. That's fine.
I mean, Edward Norton –
especially the Edward Norton character.
Yeah, over the top, man.
Oh, and he's hysterical. He's really, really funny in it. But, I mean, I guess just after a while, I sort of tired of the – premise, which is I guess that might be part of the point. Like being around these people was a little bit insufferable, but
here's how I knew it was a great movie. It's like the first time I've seen Zach Galifianakis in a movie and didn't want to throw something at the screen, and that to me is a sign of it.
I know this film is not about Michael Keaton, but it kind of parallels his career because he played Batman when?
89?
Twice, yeah, 89 and 92.
And that was kind of the peak of his movie stardom, was it not?
Sadly, sure. He should have done a lot more things.
And so he's playing a superhero who made his fame, cut his teeth on a character named Birdman, and he's now too old and too fat to play him. And he's stuck in this theater thing in New York, and he's miserable.
Right.
And he's chewing the scenery over his decline.
Right. Christian Bale needs to watch that movie. Bale played the Batman for 3 years and sort of realized if he doesn't make smart choices, this could be him in 15 or 20 years.
Now, you said that you thought I might have liked it better because I've done theater and I understand the histrionics and all this. But surely you guys must have loved the Tabitha Dickinson character. She is the single monstrously most miserable critic I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. She compares to the one in that awful M. Night Shyamalan movie, Lady in the Water, where the critic was like basically he said, "Hi, I'm so-and-so. I hate life. I hate movies. I hate children. I hate everything." And she's definitely the only one I've ever seen that compares to that.
But don't you admit, though, that there are jokes in that movie that you probably laughed a lot harder at than just the general audience?
Sure. But is that bad? Isn't that always the case? Because there's an expert in the theater in something that any movie goes after. I mean, there's somebody in that field.
Yeah. Oh, completely. Yeah. Well, and even just the divide between film acting and theater acting, mm-hmm. like where she essentially says that before she even sees his performance, "I'm going to destroy you.
Yes. Because
you belong here," kind of thing. And that you'll find that to be very, very funny. And some people be like, "I don't understand why that's a joke necessarily."
Because it does happen.
Sure, of course.
And there's absolutely great resentment in New York of all these Hollywood stars coming in and taking these lead roles on Broadway.
Which happens often.
All the time.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Because that's what it's about now. But she ends up – I shouldn't give it away. I won't give it away. This is a very strange film. It takes place almost entirely inside a Broadway theater. It goes outside somewhere sometimes. And you can't always tell reality from fantasy. And what I noticed early on is that there are these incredibly long tracking shots.
Yeah, the whole movie.
No edits, or at least you can't see the edits.
Right. In theory, it's supposed to be one uncontinuous shot from start to finish.
Wow.
But he cheats a little bit, but that's...
Yeah, he does.
But, he has to.
But I know that one segment has got to be at least 10 or 15 minutes where mm-hmm. there are no mm-hmm. edits. That has got to put incredible pressure on everybody, not just the actors, the camera guy. He can't trip, he can't miss a shot. Mm-hmm. He's got to be on his toes. It's one camera, one shot.
Well, even... Prior to the show, you were talking about the Aaron Sorkin dialogue and having to compress all of that, you know, into mastering that. You're exactly right with the skill it takes to mm-hmm. to complete a sequence and to keep moving it along and not make it feel like a gimmick is very impressive.
Yeah, you tweeted, Sean, anyone shocked that SGA, the Screen Actors Guild, embraced Birdman, a movie that largely exists to stroke actorly egos, doesn't understand this circus? What circus are you referring to?
The award circus, okay. the general pomp and circumstance of award shows, which exist to, you know, look at how important we are. And that's – Birdman struck me as an exercise in look at how important we are. And I thought that actors recognizing a movie about actors is – that's a simple equation.
See, I got the opposite impression. I thought because he's so screwed up by this Birdman thing and he can't get it out of his system and that's his claim to fame and that's gone now,
right?
That the whole thing is a shallow shell game and he's realizing.
It reminded me of The Player a lot, the Robert Altman movie, which was uh-huh. also great mm-hmm. in that, yeah, it's real just tar black satire humor.
Yeah.
It wasn't like – I don't think it was giving anybody a free pass, at least of all the actors.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But I thought it was also very much of this one guy just – constantly trying to pump himself back up, like I was more important, instead of being in the moment and realizing that the show that he was working on could have been his claim to fame, which is why I kind of thought, and it's hard to discuss it without talking about the ending.
Right, we're talking
I thought that there should have been a natural ending in the extension, the way that it went for another 10 or 15 minutes, to me felt very phony. Because
yeah.
I don't know what that ending means, to be honest with you. Like, there was a point where I thought the movie should have ended and it would have been more important to me, or it would have felt more important to me.
Okay.
It's hard to reveal that.
All right. We have 1 minute to talk about Big Hero 6. It's been out for a while, since before Thanksgiving, as have several others. So let's go very quickly to Big Hero 6. Disney Animation, you both liked it. Matt, you gave it 3.5 stars. Why?
I think it's just a lot of fun. It's got a lot of creativity and imagination. I know most people are going crazy over the Lego movie this year, which was very good. But this one I really thought was something special. Really moving.
A Lego movie. Okay.
Oh, I love the Lego movie. But I love Big Hero 6 also. I thought it had a ton of heart, a lot of really good action. And in a year where we've had so many superhero films, this to me felt like very original. It was a great origin story for an interesting superhero team that I would want to see more adventures of, and I can't say that about a lot of the superhero stuff that we watched this year.
Okay, that's Sean O'Connell. Matt Brunson is also with us. We're talking movies for the holiday season. We'll go through some of the ones that have been out for a while and then head into the ones that are opening this week and next, and then some that will open later, as a matter of fact. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction, East Independence Boulevard, inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. And the Blossom Shop, locally owned and operated since 1927, delivering a love of nature and passion for floral design through gift bouquets, to large-scale events. 3 Charlotte locations at blossomshopflorist.com. Charlotte's West Side has long felt neglected, and leaders there believe that perhaps shedding some light on the history of the area and its contributions to the fabric of Charlotte might be a catalyst for change. So journalists, historians, and civic leaders have collaborated on a book called Let There Be Light. We'll meet a few of them tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a UK study corroborates other research on the safety and cost effectiveness of low-risk deliveries by midwives, trends in maternity care, and growing support for deliveries outside of doctor-run maternity wards.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Sean O'Connell is here, film reviewer, movie content director of CinemaBlend.com, and I think on TV still?
NBC, on CNC.
Okay.
Yep.
And Matt Brunson is the film reviewer and the arts and entertainment editor and other editor hats that he wears at Creative Loafing Charlotte. Let's talk about Interstellar. I think, Sean, you brought this up a few minutes ago. It's about a man's time on Earth coming to an end and a team exploring the galaxy to find a new home. This is not unlike the 3-part miniseries on sci-fi that began last night, Ascension, where in the 1960s, President Kennedy put a bunch of people in a rocket and sent them someplace.
And on Twitter was blowing up with that show last night. I don't know. I couldn't tell if it was any good. Everybody was tweeting about it, but I didn't know if it was watchable.
It's gotten mixed reviews, but the whole the upshot of it is that there are people who were born on the rocket. They've never been to Earth, and they don't know where they're going.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
Anyway, in your review of Interstellar, a Christopher Nolan film, you talked first, Matt, about seeing it in an IMAX theater and about how the music drowned out the dialogue at times. Could that have been a bad adjustment in that theater, or is that the way the film was made? Was it you, Sean, that said that?
Oh, we both did. We sat in the same screening.
Yeah.
And tried to figure out afterwards if it was unique to our screening or – but there were a lot of people around the country complaining about similar problems.
Because I want to see it in IMAX. I don't want to see it
– Well, Christopher Nolan wants you to see it in IMAX.
Yeah, but it's a mixed bag. I mean, it wasn't just our screening. There have been complaints across the nation about this, but then other people saying, oh, I saw it. I thought it was perfectly fine. Hmm. But, the one we saw, it wasn't just the music. It was like a throbbing sound that like was really making it difficult to understand what people were saying.
And then the director tried to come out and make excuses for it, where he would say, because there were some parts where dialogue is obscured by the background, by stuff that's happening in the background. And Christopher Nolan, in his infinite wisdom, said, well, I did that on purpose, because if you were that character, the environment would prevent you from hearing unique dialogue. But you're not. You're an audience member, and you want to hear what people are saying, because sometimes it's a very important plot point.
And I don't doubt – I mean, I'm not as skeptical as Sean. I think you know, he could be telling the truth. I just think it was a bad artistic decision. If something takes you out of the movie that much, I don't think it should have been done.
Well, you gave it 3 stars. What did you think?
Oh, I hated it.
You hated it.
I actively hated it because I just thought it was I think it's really dumb. I think it's one of Christopher Nolan loves to do these intricate puzzle films, even outside of his Batman films. And when they work, like The Prestige to me, which is one of my favorite films of his, it's a seamless sort of everything snaps into place. And when they don't, like even something like Inception, I watched Inception the first time and I think I followed it all the way through, but I had no desire to go back and unbox it again. Mm-hmm. And the same problem with Interstellar. The answers might be there, but on my first view from start to finish, I had so many problems with it that I just eventually threw my hands up and gave up. And I was like, I'm not even invested in this story.
So you're kind of lukewarm. 3 out of 5 is lukewarm.
No, 4.
Four.
I only go
3 out of 4. Okay, well, then you're not lukewarm.
No, I thought it was fine. It doesn't compare to other Nolan movies like The Prestige or Inception. I thought those were definitely better. But there's certainly a lot here. It's very ambitious. I wouldn't say that it loses you. I just think it's kind of like 2001 in the way that it comes up with some questions, solutions that could kind of be interpreted
but
different
2001
ways.
Was a beautiful film.
Oh, I'm not comparing it to that in terms of the overall quality. Okay. That's obviously a masterpiece, but I'm saying this one, though, has kind of the same ambition, the same search for answers. It comes short. It comes up a little bit short, I agree, but overall I still found it fascinating.
All right. The Theory of Everything came out on Thanksgiving. I still haven't seen it. Many others may have yet to see it. This is the story of the astrophysicist Stephen Hawking, whose brilliant mind is trapped inside a body that no longer functions. I've read tepid reviews on this, but on Rotten Tomatoes it gets an 81%. You gave it you gave it 3 stars, and you say that brilliant performances are the center of this film, Matt.
Yeah, it really is. I expected just a standard biopic about Stephen Hawking, and what really surprised me was how much it was more about the relationship between him and his wife, and that allowed these two actors to really ascend.
You gave it 3.5 out of 5 stars. Is that the same level as?
Yeah, I'd say so. To me, it just feels like there's so much of his life to tackle, and it glances over some important accomplishments that he had, but the transformation of Eddie Redmayne into Stephen Hawking to me was unbelievable. And sometimes these pictures exist just to keep people in the awards conversation. And I think
the fact that he transforms physically, is that the kind of thing that gets an Oscar nomination?
Oh yeah,
completely. Oh, completely. Yeah. But I also don't want that to diminish from what he accomplished. It's a great performance, but sometimes it does sort of exist to be.
You know, the movie Elephant Man used prosthetics and other things to turn the actor into the Elephant Man. In the play, that doesn't happen. In the play, he is physically just an ordinary person, physically contorted. Is that the same thing they're doing here with
Yeah, Hawking? It's not a lot of makeup or anything, but it's the way that he holds his body, and it's the positions that he's in constantly. And there's a really eye-opening scene late in the film where the actor sort of sheds these physical transformations, and it takes place in Stephen Hawking's mind, and you sort of realize this is how he envisions himself or how he wishes he could be, and it was really touching to me.
Let's move on to some films that have just opened or will open over the holidays. Exodus, Gods and Kings. To find a good review, which was hard, I surfed over,
turn to Sean.
I surfed over to cinemablend.com, where I found Sean sitting in the comfort of his home office, which is considerably cleaner looking than mine. And like a high wire artist working without a net, Sean works without benefit of a teleprompter as he looks into his camera. Let's hear his review.
Nice.
Hey guys, and welcome to Cinemablend's 60-second review of Exodus, Gods and Kings. Are you ready? Here we go. Exodus, Gods and Kings is epic, and I know we use that term all the time, but it actually applies here, from the staging of the parting of the Red Sea to all of the plagues that descend on Egypt. Ridley Scott is painting on a massive digital canvas, and that means that even some of his mistakes are written on a big scale, but I sort of applaud him for swinging for the fences. I thoroughly enjoyed Christian Bale as Moses, finally breaking free of some of the ensemble quirky work that he's been doing lately to claim a real movie star with a capital M and a capital S performance, and I also like the way Joel Edgerton sort of countered him with this tightrope walk between drama and camp. Now, that doesn't mean that some people like Aaron Paul and Sigourney Weaver are wasted in supporting parts, because I think I could have found more for them to do. But if you're buying a ticket to see Ridley Scott's take on an Old Testament story, I think he delivers in spades.
That guy's really smart.
Well, I got to tell
you, quick.
You said that was a 60-second review, and it's only 48 seconds. Oh. I feel cheated by that.
Let me fill in the gaps. I came all the way here to give you that additional 12 seconds.
You only gave this, Matt, 1.5 stars.
Yeah.
He loved it. Talk to me about this.
I was not enamored with Christian Bale or pretty much anybody else in it. There's a lot of talk about how it was, an all-white cast in a movie that shouldn't have had that. Even just moving beyond that, I just thought it was miscast from top to bottom. I love John Turturro, but when he shows up in this, ancient Egyptian setting, with his Brooklyn accent, right away you're giggling.
Could have been true. You don't know.
There's very little I liked about it. I thought it was kind of a confused version. Noah came out earlier this year. It takes even more liberties, but it was fascinating enough, and I thought Russell Crowe was strong enough that one I got into. This one was the complete
opposite. Does
it stick
to the biblical story, or is it kind of off base there as well?
Well, I mean, it has, let's see, it has like Jaws like alligators in it, which I don't recall. It's got Moses as like this big action hero. And the best part, it's got God as this little bratty little boy who, you know, is basically just a little problem child. Yeah, none of this worked for me.
And you liked it. Why?
Well, for most of the things that didn't work for Matt worked for me, which is odd to say. Ridley Scott makes a decision to portray God as a child. Uh-huh. So when there's a burning bush and when Moses has interactions with God, it's portrayed by a child. That didn't bother me. I didn't have that big of a problem with that directorial decision. I thought Christian Bale was great, and I really enjoyed his interactions with Joel Edgerton, which a lot of people are saying didn't work.
Do you think that he chose to portray God as a child? Because in the Old Testament,
right,
God is angry a lot and has a tendency to throw what we would view as temper tantrums. Had they not been done by God. So maybe he saw an immature God at that point.
Very possible. Really? Sure. And I could support that interpretation. I mean, I think that it took as many liberties as Noah did, and I liked Noah for different reasons.
What about the all-white cast? It just seems odd to me in 2015 that you would cast everybody as a Caucasian when it all took place in Egypt.
It did, and there are roles, like Matt said, who probably could have been filled by Egyptian actors. The Aaron Paul character in particular, I'm not quite sure why he's in it.
Okay in it? Because I'm worried about him. He was so good in Breaking Bad.
This was a conversation that my wife and I had after the screening of, like, he doesn't have a lot to do. But we've seen him be a good actor in Breaking Bad, so I want to believe he has the potential, but he hasn't shown it in a big screen movie yet.
Maybe he's for speed, that's for sure.
Yeah.
He keeps choosing projects that maybe he wants to do for fun, and they're not very good.
I'm not sure. Okay. But I do think that Christian Bale gives a great performance. I really liked him in it, and people are throwing him under the bus.
Let's talk about Top 5. It's a film that we have to talk about just because of the headline for Sean's review. Hmm. A relentless, filthy, and unbearably entertaining crowd pleaser that actually needs to be seen in a theater with a lathered up group. Did you write the headline?
I did. I actually did. This is what I wanted to bring up earlier when you talked about are people going to the movies versus staying at home. And Top 5 to me strikes me as a movie that in 6 months from now, if you rent it and you watch it at home, you might not understand what the buzz was about. Part of it is seeing it in an audience and seeing how they react to some of the filthy jokes and the sequences. They're way over the top. But they get, to me, funnier in an environment where everybody's dialed into it and having a good time. And I know if I pull it up on Netflix and try and show it to my wife at home, she's going to be like, what are you talking about? This isn't funny at all. But to me, it just struck me as being really funny.
And you said you have to be prepared for an unapologetically raunchy, nasty, filthy, dirty comedy.
Yeah.
If you
for that or your horrible boss's 2 review.
Oh, I mean, did you catch it?
I saw
five?
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it pushes the envelope.
Yeah, there are some scenes. I agree. There are some scenes that do.
Yeah. Any more than Chris Rock's stand-up routine pushes the envelope.
No. But you should know that it's written and directed by Chris Rock, and it stars Chris Rock, and it's his type of humor. And I don't mind that type of humor. I think it's really, really funny.
Well, you gave it 3.5 stars. Matt, you gave it 2.5 stars and made 5 observations about this film, one of which was that you're a little concerned about this because of Richard Pryor and the Chris Rock comparison that you made, both of them brilliant comedians.
Oh, yeah.
Neither of them have distinguished themselves on film.
As well as they have in their stand-up, yeah. And the best parts of this, like Sean was saying, is when Chris Rock channels his stand-up material. I mean, again, the dirty parts are some of the funniest things I've seen on screen this year. It's when the movie turns really conventional because most of it is like this really raw movie that, it's kind of real to life. And then we end up having like this mistaken identity type subplot and all that. And that I thought was really lame and beneath the movie.
And one of you, and I don't remember which one of you wrote this, but you talk about all the guest stars, the cameo appearances that add absolutely nothing to the film.
Yeah.
Oh, I disagree with
including
that.
Jerry Seinfeld.
I thought Seinfeld had a funny part in the strip club where he's making it rain down on the dancers. And I like that people put themselves out there for that. I think that that's funny. And I'd rather
it had something funny to say. The only one I thought was funny and who wasn't playing himself was Tracy Morgan, who I thought was hilarious.
You didn't think Cedric was funny?
No, I'm sorry. Cedric the Entertainer was great.
Cedric's
but I'm
hysterical.
Saying the ones that played themselves, like Adam Sandler and Whoopi Goldberg,
yeah.
That to me, that scene did nothing.
But you'd rather see him doing this than Grown Ups 3.
Oh, yeah.
Really. Right? I mean, we agree with that.
I'd rather see anybody to anything but Grown Ups 3. Yes.
I'll give him all the credit in the world for just branching out and trying. You're right. He has not found his vehicle yet, the right vehicle.
This is the closest, though.
But yeah. But he makes a joke about that, that his character in there is coming off of a string of these ridiculous action films called Hammy the Bear, where he's dressed up in a bear suit and he's on the police force.
Shooting machine guns and saying it's hammy time.
Hammy time. So, I mean, there's a thousand jokes that, like Birdman, you know, take swipes at the industry. And I thought Chris Rock hit the target more often than not.
Okay. let's see what else is going on here. This season brings the final installment, and you've already talked a little bit about this. The Hobbit series ends with the Battle of the Five Armies. And Matt, you say, by a dwarf's hair, the best of the trilogy with more emotion and a rousing finale.
Yeah, I think they're all even keeled. They're sort of like, you know, the stepchildren of the Lord of the Rings movies, which got, you know, million Oscars, million dollars. These are a step down, but they've all been consistent. And this one, I think, rises a little more to the occasion to be the big climactic one that you want it to be. It's the first time that I was, like, actually moved by fates of characters in, the, in this saga.
Is this the kind of thing that J.R.R. Tolkien lovers will want to go out and buy the box set of when it's all said and done?
Oh, yeah, yeah. My daughter's already saving up her pennies to, you know, to go get everything.
Now, Sean's being very quiet because he doesn't like – he's afraid of short people. And hasn't seen this film
yet. I haven't. No, I haven't.
And nor has he seen Annie, the remake of the musical, which, Matt, you say was a pleasant surprise. How
so? I'm going to get hammered on this one because I think I'm going to be the only person who likes this movie. It's already getting, you know, trashed by people who haven't even seen it yet. A lot for the wrong reasons, I have to say. And when it opens, I think it's going to get trashed by people who do see it. I thought it was pleasant. I thought it was a clever reworking of the whole Annie template. I thought the older movie with Carol Burnett, Albert Finney, was absolutely awful.
Yes, it was horrible.
It was horrible. So this could only be an improvement, and it really was. I just thought the way they modernized it was very clever.
What makes it better, and how do they modernize it? It takes place in the Great Depression. How do they modernize it?
This one takes place now.
The Great Recession?
Yeah, and they have Jamie Foxx, who's in the Daddy Warbucks role. Mm-hmm. He owns, like, the cell phone company, and he's running for mayor, and so they have a lot of jokes about modern technology that I thought were well integrated into the story.
Siobhan on Facebook says, my daughter and I are excited to see the Annie remake, and my husband and I can't wait to see Top 5. Will your guests talk about, we'll have to back up a little bit, talk about Chris Rock's recent criticism of Hollywood as being a predominantly white-dominated field with an overall lack of diversity in its movies, both in front of the camera and behind the scenes. There are either black movies or Latino movies or white movies, and there doesn't seem to be a lot in between.
That's largely true, and that's another thing. I don't know how Annie's going to do at the box office. I hope it does really well because it's one of the few really mixed movies I've seen lately.
Okay.
For that reason, among many others, I hope it succeeds.
What about his comment, Chris Rock's comment about Hollywood?
I mean, I think that he's right, but it's getting harder and harder to make that argument when
what?
A film like
Exodus.
But Exodus.
But we're coming off a year where a film, you know, directed by Steve McQueen, 12 Years a Slave, wins Best Picture. I think in a week that conversation can be turned on its ear when a movie called Selma hits, because it's probably going to become an instant front runner. It's filled with amazing performances and it's directed by a female African American. So I understand why people can make that argument, but you can also point to examples where people are making a lot of headway.
Okay. So, all right, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more of our annual Christmas holiday movie preview review with Matt Brunson, the film reviewer with Creative Loafing, and Sean O'Connell with CinemaBlend.com. If you're on Twitter, what have you seen this holiday movie season? What do you want to see? Let us know your thoughts on Twitter at WFAE, and we are coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Diamonds Direct South Park, offering certified diamonds, more than 5,000 engagement ring mountings, pearls, and colored gemstones. Sharon Road across from South Park Mall, diamonds-direct.com. And Levine Museum of the New South, 'tis the season to visit with family and friends. Information about current exhibits at Levine's new website, museumofthenewsouth.org. Well, a new UK study corroborates other research on the safety and cost effectiveness of low-risk deliveries by midwives. So, trends in maternity care and growing support for deliveries outside of doctor-run maternity wards is the topic of the conversation on The Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes. And if you'd like to jump into our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Get up to date on the day's latest news by listening to All Things Considered weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE. It's your front row seat behind the headlines and offers a thorough and accurate account of what happened while you were at work. Make your commute home informative as well as entertaining with the most comprehensive news program on radio today. All Things Considered from NPR and WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Matt Brunson and Sean O'Connell, our movie critics. Let's talk about a really interesting role for Steve Carell, who is stepping out of his comfort zone, out of comedy, into drama, and into a role that when I saw the trailer, at least, I failed to recognize him for a good part of the trailer. It's partly makeup, but it's also his performance in Foxcatcher, which opens on December the 19th. I think that you've both seen it already. Sean, you've called this one of the year's best. A chilly and chilling character study with incredible performances. What's it about?
It's about Carell's character. He's John DuPont of the DuPont family, who has an unhealthy interest in wrestling. And he takes a young wrestler under his wing and wants to help him train for the Olympics. And the wrestler, Mark... Why am I blanking on his name? What's the brother's name?
Mark Ruffalo.
No. His character in the movie. He's played by Channing Tatum.
Okay.
And he and his older brother, and the older brother's played by Mark Ruffalo, are both Olympians, but the younger brother lives in the older brother's shadow, and it really, really bothers him. And he sees DuPont as a way to break free from his brother's shadow. And it's not that Ruffalo's character is domineering on top of him.
He's
insane. Yeah, exactly. But it's just the way that they misunderstand the brother's relationship. And it's how all three of them are sort of pulled into this really dark experience. And Carell's getting all the attention, but all three of the male actors in it are unbelievably great. Channing Tatum, who I dismissed years ago, has completely flipped me on how good he can be. And the movie's just fantastic. Bennett Miller is the director. He did Moneyball and he did Capote. I've loved all of his films. Yeah. He has a distinct way of making films. They're heavy and they're dense. And
maybe that's why Channing Tatum is good. He had a good director.
I'm sure. Yeah, but he also rises to the challenge of the role. It's a very difficult role emotionally to sit through.
You said that Steve Carell's performance was scary good.
It really is. It's, you know, this is the lovable comedian from Get Smart and the 40-Year-Old Virgin. And just seeing him.
And The Office. Let's not forget
that. And The Office. And just seeing him in this part, it's just an incredible transformation. But like Sean said, all three actors are really incredible in this.
Another film that opens this weekend is Wild. Reese Witherspoon stars in this. So as Sean, you call it an emotional, physical, psychological, and spiritual tour de force for her. You gave it 4 out of 5 stars. Matt, you say this is more than just a showcase for her, but a potent drama about a woman rediscovering herself. It's an adaptation from a memoir by Cheryl Strayed about her being at a crossroads and dealing with it by taking a 3-month solo hike up the Pacific Crest Trail. How can that be a good movie?
I just caught this past weekend. And like I was telling Sean before the show, I'd been hearing about how she's really fantastic, the rest of the movie, take or leave. And I don't agree with that. I think the movie as a whole is quite good. It's the same director who did Dallas Buyers Club. And he has this really unique eye and the use of the music in this movie and flashbacks. It's kind of done in it's hard. You have to see it to understand it. But it's done in a really subtle, different way that I thought really made the movie even more powerful.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's not just a woman on a trail hiking through nature. The way that when he chooses to access her flashbacks totally complements the reasons as to why she's on this journey, and it's very compelling. Witherspoon is as good as advertised, but the movie is really good too.
Let's talk about another movie musical that's coming out, Into the Woods. It's a Stephen Sondheim musical, and if you look at the trailers on television or in the theaters, you would be hard-pressed to tell that it was a musical, because all you hear is underscoring. You don't hear any singing from anybody, at least in most of these trailers. Why? Why do a Stephen Sondheim musical and then de-emphasize the fact that it's a musical? Aren't you going to tick people off when they go to the theater?
Well, there's no music.
They're singing?
It's like The Artist. There's no dialogue, no music or anything. It's a silent movie.
No, what you brought up is what sort of annoyed me about it. And it's sort of what takes me out of a lot of these modern musicals is that there aren't any more big numbers anymore. It's one consistent.
It's a sung through Broadway musical. It's very little dialogue in the Broadway version. It's all sung mostly.
Right.
Not all of it.
And so after an hour of that, yeah. I'm always tapping out. I'm like, because I'd rather there be.
Why don't you like theater, Sean?
I do like theater. I do. But I don't always like people's interpretations of it. And the thing about the director, Rob Marshall, is he hit a home run to me with Chicago years ago. Yeah. And he's been chasing that high ever since.
But see, that's a completely different kind of musical.
Right.
That is a musical with big numbers in it.
Right. Okay. Then I prefer those,
okay.
I guess.
This is more like opera.
I guess.
But not opera, because it's not sung that way.
But what's annoying me now in the aftermath of it all is the praise that's being heaped on the cast, who I think are all fine, and especially Meryl Streep, who we've been talking about. Like, she's receiving all of these nominations for playing the witch in it.
Right.
She doesn't have a ton of screen time, and what she does with it is just fine.
Bring back Bernadette Peters.
That's what you said in your review, and she played it on Broadway, did they need the star power?
They want the star power, yeah. She's the one that's in all the posters.
And Johnny Depp is in this film as the, as the wolf in the Little Red Riding Hood sequence. This is his second Sondheim musical after Sweeney Todd. Does he bring something special to this, or is this another in his series of very weird interpretations?
It's that. That. And he's hardly in it. He's in it, 5 minutes?
Pretty much.
That's good.
Yeah. But there are also these – correct me if I'm wrong from the original stage play. There's a lot more darker and sort of – sexual undertones to the wolf.
They cut it all.
By Disney, yeah. Right. So if you're not going to hand that material to the director who's going to tap into that.
I'm astounded by two things.
It?
A, why did Disney do it? B, why did Sondheim let Disney do it? And C, why is Sondheim's name not to be found on the trailers? You can't find it. It's there, I'm sure, but you just not. It's not there.
Oh, I think it was him. I don't think it was somebody else. Actually, wrote a new song for the movie. It's one of those.
It'd have to be him.
Yeah, it's one of those they do all the time, like they did with Evita, and I think even Annie. That they write a new song specifically to get an Oscar nomination. Don't tell me it's any other.
Because Sean,
reason.
You said this is cute but largely unremarkable. A lot of talent spent in favor of a humdrum musical. Are you calling the film humdrum, or are you calling Sondheim humdrum?
No, not Sondheim. The film in general. To me, I love when filmmakers take an existing musical and put something really unique and put a really fresh spin on it. And it doesn't happen often, because more often than not, you get a lot of famous people getting together to just replicate a musical, and it just sort of sits there. And this, to me, just sort of sat there. It didn't conjure any new energy, and it didn't interpret it in any different way for me. It just... I don't know.
All right. Well, let's move on to something else. We're going to gallop through these next several, I'm thinking. Sean, you have not yet seen Big Eyes. You're watching it tonight. Matt, you have seen it, and you're singing the praises of Amy Adams and Christoph Waltz and their performances. This is a Tim Burton film, which is always strange. What's it about?
It's about the artist Margaret Keane and her husband Walter, and how for the longest time he took credit for her artwork. And so for most of it, it's about how he was micromanaging their relationship and their careers. Mm-hmm. And then she eventually takes him to court. And then that's the whole final part of the movie.
Sounds very different from Tim Burton, though. Is it really different from what he normally does?
Kind of. But at the same time, it's by the same guys who wrote his Ed Wood. So there's like a lot of playing around with facts and stuff, and but it's entertaining, and the two stars are really good.
Okay, you've also beaten Sean to the viewing of a remake of the 1970s James Caan film, The Gambler. This time with Mark Wahlberg, who you say starts strong but fizzles out. Why?
It's one that it's really compelling for the longest time because of Mark Wahlberg's performance and the character and his relationships with everybody. And then it's one of those – I haven't seen the original, so I don't know it compares to that. But in this one, the whole story just kind of peters out. There's like you keep expecting some ingenious twist or development, at least some drama, and it just kind of – it's not there.
You wrote, Sean, The Imitation Game is a first-rate biopic, a thrilling espionage game that's beautifully crafted and acted. This is the story of the man who developed the Enigma machine.
No, or cracked
the Enigma machine, excuse me, cracking the Nazi code in World War II. Alan Turing, as played by Benedict Cumberbatch, you call his performance great.
I did, and I call it Sherlockian, and I got a lot of flack for that. But well, I meant that as a compliment. I meant it as a compliment, and I don't mean to say that he keeps doing the same persona over and over again, but I just mean that he's very good at playing that. As someone who's kind of introverted, thinks he's better than you are, and largely is. And it taps into his ability to play that, but in a different way. To me, it almost had the feeling of this underdog sports team, because it's these brilliant minds who have to get together to try and crack this Enigma code to shorten the time of the war. And when they – spoiler alert, when they do it, it's a triumphant scene, and it really gets you caught up in it. But there's also this over – there's a frame story about the way that he's sort of persecuted by the British government because it turns out that he's gay. And when that's revealed, it was a crime at the time. Mm-hmm. And that's a very touching story also. They don't shortchange it in this film. I was really impressed by it.
Okay, that's called The Imitation Game. Why is it called The Imitation Game?
That's a good question. Because of the way he has to pretend to be.
Okay. On the other hand, Sean, you say that, you said about The Imitation Game, that it's tough to dismiss. It's touching, it's tragic, it's romantic. It's as romantic as it is intelligent and compelling. On the other hand, you say that Unbroken, directed by Angelina Jolie, is Oscar bait that fails to emerge. Matt, you seem to agree. You say that film is solid, if unremarkable. It's about an Olympic athlete and World War II prisoner, Lou Zamperini, who received a special screening of this film in his hospital room days before he died. Where did Angelina Jolie go wrong?
She didn't go wrong. I liked it. You know, it's a respectable movie, but you know, if we're talking about awards contenders, which it certainly is being pushed up for, to me it's kind of like Clint Eastwood's American Sniper, which is coming out later. They're competent movies, but they don't rise above the level of to like The Imitation Game or something that makes you want to go out and vote for them.
When you watch the trailer, it's reminiscent, at least to me, of World War II films that were made during World War II to bolster the people at home and put the good guy face on the boys at war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but a lot of times those films, to me at least, they, as you're sitting through them, they feel like homework. Like you're supposed to sit through them because they're supposed to feel important.
Uh-huh.
And there are movies, I keep going back to Selma, like Imitation Game, which recount the past, but do it in such an engaging way that you are really invested in the story being told. And with Unbroken, I just never penetrated it.
So then given the fact that she didn't make diamonds out of this coal, this lump of coal, are the memos leaked as a result of the Sony hacking about Angelina Jolie's lack of talent accurate?
Not at all. I mean, she was in Maleficent. She was terrific in that. I think that was a very unfair email.
But her two directorial efforts haven't yet overwhelmed me. You know, like she might need to find the right material. She has talent.
Well, you know, it's hard. I would think it's really hard for somebody of the stature of Angelina Jolie to do anything different because she's so public. You can't try something out. You can't fail in a small venue. You have to put it on a big screen, and it's Angelina Jolie. So when you fail, if you fail,
right,
it's a spectacular film.
Right, because
so it's very brave to do what she did.
And there's there's an actor, Jack O'Connell is the name of the actor, no relation, who is really outstanding. And he's in another film called 71 that's getting a lot of buzz this year. And if it wasn't directed by Angelina Jolie, I think he'd be the story. But you're right, Angelina Jolie's name casts a larger shadow over it.
All right. You mentioned a film just before we went to break last time, and it's in limited release now. It will actually open here, I think, in 2015, and that's Selma, about Martin Luther King Jr. And the Selma to Montgomery March for voting rights. On Twitter, Sean, you said, "I despise recognizing films on year-end top 10 lists that screen the week before Oscar voting because films need to breathe, but Selma is that good?" And you said you think it's one of the best of the year.
It really is. On my mindset, and Matt's probably also right now, we watch a lot of things in this push, and we view it towards top 10 inclusion. And I just don't like doing that because I don't want to be like, I just saw something great. Oh, put it on the top 10. Because I really want to sit back a little bit and think, like, is this really a top 10 film? Mm-hmm. Selma, to me, instantly just declares itself, like, I am an important film, not only of the period that it's covering, but of the moment right now. And the performances are so incredibly good. Mm-hmm. But it's also, it's not history at a distance. Like, it doesn't feel like you're being preached to, or it's so immersive. And it's hard to describe the way the director put you in the story, and it's aided by the performances and it's aided by all the choices. It just works so well, and I hope people give it a chance because it was really great.
He's right. I mean, it definitely vaulted onto my 10 best. It's a really powerful movie. Tom Wilkinson as Lyndon B. Johnson, you know, that takes a little getting used to. Yeah. But everybody else in the movie is really incredible, and it's so relevant. I'm not going to see a more relevant movie this year than this one, topical.
Another of the 2015 films is American Sniper. It's a Clint Eastwood film that the two of you disagree about. Matt, you say it features a fine turn by Bradley Cooper, but there's little here we haven't seen before. And Sean, you say it is Clint Eastwood's best in years, an absorbing look at what war does to a soldier's psyche, especially when he returns home and is dying to go back and serve his country. Did you both see the same movie?
Well, I don't disagree that it's his best in years.
We have to clarify.
We have to clarify,
exactly. Clint's films lately have been bad.
Yeah, they haven't been that great.
And this one's watchable.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's his best in years.
Okay.
But no, I just want to say, like, the first 10 to 15 minutes have all of Clint's obstacles. It's melodramatic. It's hammy. And then it turned and became far more interesting and compelling, and largely because of Bradley Cooper and how good he is.
And to me, it's just like Unbroken. I liked it. There's nothing wrong with it, but it didn't inspire me as a movie should.
So we have 45 seconds to talk about a most violent year. It's another look at the American dream. You call it hazy, druggy.
Oh, no, that's Inherent Vice.
What? Really?
I think so.
Well, here's what I said.
Go ahead.
Here's what I say you said.
Okay.
It's a hazy, druggy mystery movie with great performances, but damn, it's strange.
That's Inherent Vice.
How did I make that mistake?
I'm not sure. I blame your producers.
Okay, thank you. Let's put it off on you. You say, if I'm not wrong, that features top turns by Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain. Is that the right movie?
No, we're talking about Annie. But, no, yes, that's correct. The most violent year. it's a good movie. It's one that's going to get under the cracks, and it shouldn't.
Okay, I'll blame the whole show on the producers today. Sean O'Connell, film reviewer and movie content director of CinemaBlend.com. Matt Brunson, film reviewer for Creative Loafing, and many other hats worn periodically throughout the day. Thank you both. It's always fun.
Yep.
Thanks, Mike.